Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
The FBI. How many times have you seen movies or TV shows about that intrepid organisation? Hello, Robin Williams with In Conversation, and this time with someone who heads one of the FBI's forensic labs. You'll be amazed how much science is required for their investigations. The host for the FBI in Australia was Bond University, Professor Angela Van Dahl, whom I've talked to before on The Science Show. Here she is on using genes, yes, genes, to tell what victims or villains look like.
Our DNA also contains all the information that describes what we look like, whether we have blue eyes or brown eyes, whether we're tall or short. And so what I'm interested in doing is decoding that information, finding out what it is that does make us look like we look like, so that in the future, where there's a crime scene, where there's a no suspect, for example, like the Wee-Wa rape case of several years ago, that police would be able to take that evidence item and do a DNA test and provide essentially an identikit picture of the person. So it's like having an eyewitness at the crime.
Do you mean you could read off parts of the DNA and from it build up a picture of what that person looks like?
Yes.
That's astonishing.
Yes. But it will happen in the future. It's obviously a very complex thing, but we've already made some progress. There are a few genes we know of that are involved in, for example, red hair. We know there's a particular gene that if you have one or two changes at that gene, you are very likely to have red hair. We also have found a gene that we have, again, one or two changes where there's a much stronger association with dark colouring. So we're making progress, but yes, it's a complex thing. But down the track, we will be doing that, I think.
How much can be done now?
Now, very limited, the test I just described, and there are a few genes, as I said, we know about involved in pigmentation. I'm also working on genes involved in height and in facial morphology, but we don't know enough yet to provide very useful information. But I would say within 5 years, we might be able to provide much more information on that.
Within 5 years, would you be able to tell whether it's me or whether it's my colleague Norman Swan or whether it's someone...
I'm sure it wouldn't be you, Robin.
You have no idea what we get up to.
I hate to think. Well, even at this early stage, we could, for example, I mentioned the gene that associated with red hair and the one we've got with dark colouring. We could do those tests at this stage and predict whether the person might have red hair or be dark in colouring. So we could do that already.
The shape of sleuthing to come, Angela Van Dahl at Bond University in southern Queensland. She's been looking after Dr. Bruce Bedoli, an FBI veteran of 20 years, who's head of their lab in Virginia and sometimes called the FBI's top scientist. He's not only involved in forensics, but also in the Bureau's extensive efforts in counter-terrorism. Bruce Bedoli, could you take us back to a few years ago when there were mysterious envelopes arriving on desks in the United States that seemed to contain a strange powder, the anthrax mystery? Could you tell us what happened and what happened next?
Well, if you have to remember, 9/11 had just occurred and, you know, the World Trade Centers had collapsed. And so, of course, we were already on high alert about terrorism and the issues and security risks that we had at the moment. And subsequent to that, there were letters mailed through the Postal Service containing the bacterium called Bacillus anthracis, which is the microorganism that causes the disease anthrax. And it was sent through the mail, which became a rather effective way of disseminating the material to various news media and politicians' offices.
And then it was analyzed, was it?
Well, there's a couple things in it. The first person exposed to it, there was no letters ever found. That was Robert Stevens in the AMI building in Florida. He was discovered as having the disease by an astute physician who did a very good differential diagnosis and determined he had anthrax. After that, then people started to look into the building and do some searching and found spores. At the same time, then the letters became apparent and we were very quickly identified as Bacillus anthracis.
Of what particular origin? Because is it possible to look at the sort of anthrax you've got and then to trace back to see what its origins might have been?
Well, there's a lot of different things that can be done with microorganisms in general. Sometimes if you know the strain, which, I mean, although we talk about anthrax, there are different strains, and one strain may be found in one part of the country or one part of the world, and another strain, and or it may be something that's been used in a weapons program in the past, you know, maybe 30, 40 years ago, and that can give you some suggestions of where to look.
And this can be done by analyzing the sort of anthrax you've got, the DNA fingerprint, if you like.
Something like that. If you look into the DNA, there are genetic signatures that can help identify the particular strain. That's very well established for many years.
Now, as a matter of general interest, that happened, as you said, some years ago. Was anyone ever arrested as a result of that inquiry?
Well, it's an ongoing investigation, so I can't comment any further on it at this point.
You talked about fingerprinting. That was in itself something rather controversial way back, I think, at the beginning of the 1980s. Sir Alec Jeffries, I do believe, in Britain, was the pioneer of that. Do you know him?
I know him personally very well. And, of course, I would never use the term DNA fingerprinting because I don't think it's a good moniker for what we do. But the concepts there is that if you do enough and the right kind of genetic markers, you can essentially identify an individual to the exclusion of all others unless they have an identical twin. Actually, the technology wasn't as controversial as one thinks, but because of the legal systems that we enjoy both in Australia and the United States, the adversarial system, it is the duty of the defense to challenge the evidence and to vehemently represent their clients. So they will take on any charge they can to try to, say, at least mollify or discredit the evidence to some degree. And that became more of the controversy. If you look at what we actually did and all the work that was done, we did it correctly from the beginning.
But I suppose some of the arguments are that you don't necessarily get the entire genome lying there for you. What you get are bits and pieces. And so the argument from the defense is if you've only got something like 1%, that section of it, plus another little bit here, how can you be sure that all of that stuff, which is just a representation of the DNA, can give you enough to be certain of what you've got?
Well, let me give you an analogy that might be a little bit different, but you've ever played poker before?
I have done way back.
Okay, way back. Same here. I don't do it anymore because that would be unprofessional. If you took five cards out and said, what's the chance of getting four aces and a king? You only have 1/10 of the deck, right? So it's only a small portion of the deck. And yet, what's the odds of four aces? Very remote. And so you don't need all of it to be able to identify something that's exceedingly rare. Same thing with DNA. If you choose genetic regions that are highly variable amongst people in the population and you put a series of them together, it's the same thing as pulling out cards from a deck and getting a specific hand, exceedingly rare. So you don't have to look at all the DNA. And in fact, if you looked at all the DNA, it would be somewhat of a useless exercise because over 99%+ of all our DNA is exactly the same. That's what makes us all humans. So you only want to look at regions that are informative and not spend your time looking at things that would be uninformative.
Apart from that, it takes so long to analyze all this stuff. I think one of the figures at the back of my head is that there's something like 200,000 examinations of DNA, particular cases, as a backlog at any one time that the police or whomever are investigating, say in the United States. So getting through all that, if you had to do the entire DNA, you'd be working till doomsday, wouldn't you?
Well, I mean, it's really not practically feasible or economically feasible to do that anyway. But there's a couple of points in there to comment on. One is any one DNA case doesn't take long. If a sample came in, you could actually, in theory, analyze it within a day or two if one wanted to do that. One of the reasons that there's backlogs is the success of DNA is its own worst enemy in a sense, because as you become more and more successful, you look at more and more samples to type that were not typable before by other traditional or current means at that time. So therefore, the more and more you become successful, the more and more likely you're going to be able to see more samples coming in and such. There's another point to consider as well is it may not be best for society for us to look at all the DNA that a person has. And we've purposely tried to avoid things that would affect or impact the privacy of an individual. So if I had the ability to look at all your DNA, I might find that you have some genes that may give you a predisposition to a cancer or heart disease or something else. And that wouldn't be appropriate for the police to have that kind of information. So in my mind, we're better off looking at the DNA that we look at now, which does not have those kinds of signatures or information about the individual's personal features or disease predilections or something.
Fair enough. Professor Bodoli, you're in charge of a major laboratory in the FBI in the United States, looking at a whole range of investigations. Give us an idea of the sorts of things that you're doing now, some years after anthrax, the way that the field has developed by 2008.
Well, what we did is develop this field called microbial forensics, a field that's specific to looking at evidence that might come in from a bioterrorism or biocrime act, and trying to develop all the kinds of tools and practices that could be used to help characterize that evidence to give investigative leads for the police and law enforcement, FBI, to be able to identify those who would perpetrate the crime. We also are building an infrastructure so that if there's another event, we can rapidly mobilize and address the crime scene and analyze the evidence in a much more rapid manner than we ever could before.
And in what connection with bioterrorism?
Well, again, bioterrorism is using a microorganism, a toxin, or other related products, or even material that's innocuous in a manner of a hoax, to commit a crime. And when that occurs, we use whatever evidence is found at the crime scene to be able to characterize it to hope to identify the person who committed that crime. So if there's a micro, we have two types of situations. We can have an overt attack or a covert attack. An overt attack would be something like a package is found in a train station and written on it is the word anthrax, or there's a powder in it and people are concerned and it may be real or may not. We want to, of course, address those. The other one is the covert attack where you don't know that it's been perpetrated, but yet all of a sudden people, animals, plants are becoming ill or dying. And you wonder first if it's a natural disease or if it's an intentional attack. We have to figure those things out. And then, same thing, can we use any of that evidence that the microorganism has or the package or whatever it may be to help trace back to the one who committed that crime?
It's been interesting in recent times that with all the attacks that there've been using fairly conventional weapons, there's been very little using bioweapons, presumably because they're so hard to control and maybe you affect your own people, residents and so on, the general public over a longer time. Have you been surprised at how little this sort of weaponry has been used?
Well, being somewhat of a scientist, and scientists are somewhat historians as well, if you look back over history, there's actually many examples of microorganisms being used as bioweapons, as far back as the ancient Abyssinians to current day countries and individuals in the 20th and 21st century. So it's not the first time that we've heard this, and there are many examples of these one-on-ones to large numbers of individuals being attacked. However, I do think that there's something about bioweapons that most scientists have an aversion to, and that they're not have this desire to use them in that kind of manner. I think we're all sort of trained with certain science ethics and such that it seems to be that people don't want to help do that. They look at it more as a use to make good, not bad. And therefore, I think we're not going to see as much. But your points about also is they may be easy to grow, but they may be hard to actually disseminate. And so that limits their use as well.
Absolutely. Mind you, you still have to be vigilant, and therefore you have to have, as you said, the equipment to go in on the mysterious package and find out fairly quickly, or if there is a disease in some town, to check out whether this happens to be something that may have been perpetrated. I suppose it's fairly difficult to tell on the face of it whether an outbreak is a natural one or something that's been planted by some villain.
You're absolutely right. It depends on the situation. Some would be obvious. For instance, if there was an outbreak of smallpox, no one would consider it being a natural outbreak today because it's been eradicated. It would automatically be thought of as a terrorist act. Others may be more difficult. They may look like the natural background. And that's why it's so important for the government agencies to work together. For instance, the FBI and our Centers for Disease Control have a memorandum of understanding. We work these cases together so that if something starts out as a public health incident, that may have been a true attack were read into it immediately, as they are into our work, so that everybody knows what's happening, so the best decisions can be made. If you only have your public health looking at things, then they only treat it as a public health incident. If you have law enforcement looking at it, they only treat it looking as law enforcement. You need the two to work together to actually get the best effective interpretation of what may have happened.
You mentioned smallpox just now, and that goes back to a decision that was taken a few years ago as to whether to eliminate it from the face of the earth. And I think two stores remained, one in Russia and one in the United States.
Yes, it's true.
Just to be able to identify something should it turn up later. Now, there was a rumour that the Russians were unfortunately thinking of using the store to develop some sort of weaponry. Is there any more information on that and the progress in 2008 as to whether they've done so or not?
I actually don't know anything about that rumor, so I couldn't comment on that. But it does bring up an interesting point. You know, prior to 2001, there was a projected date that these stores were going to be destroyed because there was no need for them anymore. And because of the now concern about bioterrorism, that has been put on halt for a while because you would need these materials potentially to produce a therapeutic or vaccine that would be used to prevent spread of disease. So climates change and, you know, dynamics change as events occur. So it's another one of those areas of effect of what happened by one event just in recent years.
Professor Angela Van Dahl, you're with Professor Bedoli and you're from Bond University and you're his host. Listening to these rather disturbing topics about terrorism and subterfuge and so on, how much relevance does that have to the Australian scene?
Well, I think it does have relevance. Obviously, this is a global issue. And one of the things that Bruce has mentioned I think is really important in this context. I think it's very important that we, at an international level as well as domestic levels, work together. And Australia, in fact, has MOUs, for example, with the Department of Homeland Security, and I think these things are important. We have microorganisms here in Australia that are not present in other countries, which potentially can be used for a bioterrorism attack. And so it's important for all of us to work together in being as prepared as we can for hopefully what won't happen. But yeah, I do believe that interaction internationally is a very important part of science now.
And you're sharing techniques, you're sharing approaches, are you?
Yes, we have a number of collaborations we're working on.
With the FBI?
Yes, we are specifically working on some aspects of the human DNA identification part of forensics with the FBI and with academic colleagues in the United States.
And during the time that Professor Bedoli's here, what sorts of things will you be examining together?
We're actually looking at developing further interactions. So, for example, we have visited the Australian Federal Police in Canberra and talked about biosecurity issues with the relevant departments there. We've talked about some of the issues associated with the human DNA identification field. You talked about the backlogs that exist and the databases. Bruce has advised the Australian people here on some of those issues and helped them in developing our database.
And of course there's the question of identifying victims of things like the World Trade Center bombing and various other examples of, you know, mass murder. In Bosnia, for example, a number of anthropologists have been looking at the buried corpses. And then the identification of the DNA comes in. How much demand is there from families and others for that sort of thing, Professor Bedoli?
Well, again, for our cultures and societies, we desire to identify our victims of mass disasters or of attacks and such. So that's one of the first things that's thought about is when there's a victim is how to identify them. In fact, in the United States, we have thousands of missing persons where the vast majority of the human remains that we have of those have been due to some sort of nefarious act. Usually they've been killed in some fashion that warrants an investigation as well, and families are looking for their loved ones. And so we have an active program in the U.S. and several crime labs and the FBI to identify these missing persons.
Even thousands involved with the World Trade Center disaster. It seems an almost impossible task with the bits spread over the city still to be looking into evidence for a particular person. Is that still going on?
Well, actually, there's still a remnant of the program going on, no pun intended, but every once in a while you still hear in the news that a few shards or fragments have been found and they continue onward. About half the people who went missing have been identified, at least a portion of them, through the analyses that were done over the past few years. But the other half probably will never be identified given the nature of the terrible event that occurred.
And I suppose the question is proving that someone was actually there rather than, you know, didn't turn up at the World Trade Center and went somewhere else and has gone missing.
Well, there are obviously issues there. I mean, there have been, a handful or less examples of people who tried to carry out some insurance fraud based on saying that, you know, they disappeared and were killed. But I think most of the cases are pretty well verified by lots of other means, and they've been settled even without the human remains to identify them. But it's not so much the verification in that manner, it's the verification for the people who are still alive, who lost loved ones, trying to have something of their loved ones to take, hold, bury, and have closure.
Whose role is that? Is it the police role, the FBI's role, or what?
It varies depending on the particular situation. Now, the one in New York City, actually, the role was, of course, under New York jurisdiction, so it became part of New York's responsibility, and then others were invited in, such as ourselves, to work on that. The one that occurred in the Pentagon bombing, obviously, that's the federal government, and most of the work that was done for that analysis was done at the Armed Forces DNA Identification Lab, which does a lot of the kind of plane crashes and such analyses. Then others help in joining in. But the role, there may have been a role in leadership, but there were many, many organizations and institutions, both private and public, that worked on these to help contribute to address this massive task.
Question for both of you to end. How do you see this field growing in the future? What sort of techniques have we got to look forward to that will make the whole process even more efficient and accurate, if you like? First, Professor Badoli.
Okay, well, there's a couple areas, and I'll lead off with what I'll defer to Professor Van Dahl here in a little while about, but there are various situations where we have samples that are very challenged. They've been exposed to the environment, a lot of heat, humidity, maybe bacteria, fungal growth on them, and they degrade. So there's smaller and smaller amounts of DNA in there that are degraded and very difficult to analyze. So we're looking at other genetic markers that are more amenable to working on degraded samples, and we call them SNPs, which are just genetic markers that are scattered throughout our DNA. And one of the areas that we're working on is developing different classes of SNPs, and one that Professor Van Dahl is working on is looking at SNPs that will actually allow us to decipher the features of the individual who was the donor or the owner of that particular sample. And I think within the next 2 to 5 years, we're going to see a lot of success in that area. And the real value of that is that you have a case where there's no suspect. Police have no lead. In theory, what we would like to do is be able to extract the DNA from that sample and do a reconstruction of the person's physical features, the shape of their eyes, their nose, their mouth, ears, better than, let's say, an eyewitness account would ever be, and give them a better investigative lead than they have now. The other areas we'd like to work on is improving the technology in. You talked about backlogs. Well, backlogs are a serious issue because it takes a lot of work to do a case. There's some cases it takes a lot of manpower, a lot of time, and a lot of cost. And some of the methods we're looking at today, we could reduce that time, you know, tenfold, and the cost 20 to 15% of the cost we do now. That means we can do more samples in less time, and that'd be another tremendous value and advantage.
Angela Van Dahl, we've talked about those feature investigations before. In the 1 minute that's left, how much can you identify of someone's face, say, features?
Right now we don't have the information to get to their face, but we're working on developing those markers. But what we do have at this point that we're looking to implementing in some kind of a product for the community is the ability to look at the pigmentation, so hair, skin and eye colour. And if you think about missing person cases, when, you know, everyone's seen on CSI kind of shows where they do the facial reconstructions, if we can add even pigmentation as a starting point to that description, that I think will make a big difference.
Professor Angela Van Dahl at Bond University in Queensland with Dr. Bruce Badoli from the FBI's lab in Virginia. Next week at this time, I shall be in conversation with two anthropologists who know all about babies, both from Cambridge. Karen Kramer is at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Marilyn Strathern is head of Girton College, Cambridge in England. Production today by Nikki Phillips. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National. on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.